The topic which I've chosen for this evening's lecture, Individuality and Individualism, the Jewish Perspective, is chosen for what might be described both general and rather personal reasons. In one sense, it lies at the heart of a great deal of social and ethical theory. Another plane, however, I'm drawn to it in the fact that it relates to various aspects of my own interests and experience. It is, on one hand, central to any religious thinking shown generally, and of course to your habits specifically. On the other hand, it is a major concern of humanistic culture and of literature particularly. At another level, it provides, in part, an opportunity for elaborating to some extent the contrast between American and Israeli experience. And finally, it enables me to function, albeit in a limited sense, in a dual capacity, that it lends itself not only to the dispassionate analysis of the academician, but to the somewhat more hortatory strain which is the hallmark of the Rosh Hashiva. There is, I might add, a certain advantage in this latter dual stance. On a subject so broad, so basic, it is difficult, perhaps also inadvisable, to strive for genuine novelty. But while the moral philosopher is expected to innovate, the moralist of a yeshiva, even as he too is animated by the thought that Amos HaMidrash v'lechidush, is nevertheless buttressed by the concept developed in the opening words of the Mesillas Yeshurim, אמר המחבר, החיבור הזה לא חיברתי ולמד את זה הודו מאשר שלא יודו, אלא להזכירו מה שידוע להם כבר ובפורסום אצלם פרסום גודל. It also states this work was not written in order to teach people that which they do not yet know, but rather in order to remind them of that which is known to them and well understood by them. Or as Dr. Johnson would put it, men do not need so much to be instructed as to be reminded. So I hope that even those who come away from this evening's lecture uninstructed will at least consider themselves to have been reminded. The two terms I have chosen to analyze and concurrently contrast this evening have each of them, particularly if we go back to their classical origins, a long and somewhat checkered history. It is not my intention, however, to trace the linguistic course etymologically and inductively, but rather to define them, not altogether arbitrarily, of course, for our purposes, and to use the definition as a basis for emphasizing, and here I return to the exhortation, a particular thesis. To begin with the first term, individuality. The term, regarded in part as a phenomenon, and in part as a value, includes several components. The first, at once the most obvious and the most closely related to the etymology of the term, is the simple fact of singularity. The fact that a given reality constitutes a separate entity, that it can neither be further subdivided, nor on the other hand, be lumped together as part of a mass, but is rather to be regarded and to be dealt with as a discrete unit. As applied to man, singularity is, of course, in part a physical, or if you will, a biological fact. But for our purposes, and with reference to the ethical sphere, it is preeminently a metaphysical reality and a spiritual goal. As such, the concept has been particularly emphasized and championed by Yahadis. This emphasis has found varied expression. At one level, it is reflected in the concept of Hashgacha Pratit, that is, the concept that while as many Rishonim held with regard to the physical and the animal world, there obtains only a kind of general and universal providence. With respect to man, there is an individual, a personal providence. At another level, it relates to many moral and ethical obligations, grounded in the need to regard each individual in his own right. At a third, it is perhaps symbolically reflected in the Issur, amplified by the Ramban, commenting upon last week's Seder, in the Issur against counting people, simply taking a census, and therefore quantifying people, unnecessarily. Primarily, however, it is the basis of a concept which is the cornerstone of any Torah anthropology, the concept of Tzelem Elokim, the image of God, or to use Milton's phrase, the human face divine. Whatever else that concept may entail, and Rishonim, starting with the Rambam, the very first part of the Maran Avuchim, have dealt with the subject in extenso, it is grounded in the profound belief in the Rabbeinu Shleilem's singularity, which Lahavdil Tatis Mutandis defines human existence as well. Ato Echod, Thou art One, implies, among other things, separateness. A separateness which translates into Ata Kodosh, Thou art holy, in Otto's terms, the holy other, Muflash, Mugdo, in a word, transcendence. And this separateness has its correlative, again, Mutatis Mutandis, in the human sphere as well. This concept of human singularity is so basic to Yahadus, and the committed Jew is so thoroughly suffused with it, we may not be fully aware of its significance. That may perhaps be better appreciated if we reflect not only upon what there is in Yahadus, but upon what there is not. The sense, for instance, of cosmic union, blending, as it were, into the universe, whether regarded as an existing fact from the standpoint of evolutionary biological theory, or as a summa bonum, man's ultimate highest good, within the context of either oriental religion from medieval Christian mysticism, is he artist? Largely absent. Man is thus regarded as part of a collective life force, to use George Bernard Shaw's phrase, but as a being who stands in dialectical relation to his environment, encompassed by it, and an extension of it, on the one hand, is implied by the first account of the creation in Bereshit, and yet apart from it, in a world unto himself, as implied by the second. Next to the urge to lose oneself and one's identity by blending into universal being, that urge which has so profoundly animated mystics east and west, that too is within Yahadus at most thoroughly muted. It is significant neither within the mainstream nor within the major tributaries of Jewish thought. Even with respect to man's personal relation to God, the preeminent concept is covenant, involving, of course, two sides, rather than total abnegation. And the attitude is conceived not as the loss of self, but as its realization and fulfillment. The righteous sit, contemplate, with a halo upon their heads. The second factor, whose relative insignificance within Yahadut might be noted, is radical social organicism. The notion that a person is regarded as simply a cell within large units is thoroughly alien to Yahadut. With regard to the scope of an organic component within Jewish social thought, differences admittedly exist. The strain which runs from the Kuzari to the Mahal down to Rav Kook certainly emphasizes it more than did the Rambam and his spiritual heirs down to Mehi Rabbi Zerof. But the notion that even the nature of the destiny of the individual could be defined purely or even largely with reference to the collection, to the collective, is found, for instance, in much 19th century thought, is of little importance within Jewish tradition. And this, again, is a reflection of the pervasive force of the idea of Tzelem Elokim, of human singularity. The second component of the idea of human individuality is different. An individual is not only distinct, but distinctive, not only singular, but other, in a sense, again, paralleling the Rabban Shalom's existence, even unique. Within Chazal, this concept is, of course, generally associated with the Gemara and Sanhedrin. This indicates the greatness of the Rabbeinu Shloim, that whereas normally a person who has a stamps many coins, they all resemble one another, whereas the Rabbeinu Shloim stamps everyone with the imprint of primal man, and yet none quite resembles the other. And this lack of resemblance, of course, as I'll say elsewhere, is not only with regard to one's physiognomy, but with regard to character as well. Shem Shem Pasutei Shovim, כך אם זה יוצא ישור. In this text, in the Sanhedrin, of course, brings us back once again to the roots of historical human existence and to the concept of Tzelem. So the concept of Tzelem in the king can be understood to mean, maybe the Rabbi, Rabban Soloveitchik, frequently emphasized, can be understood to mean that there is not simply one image, but many. And that the realization of Tzelem is not just the personal achievement of a common goal, but the fulfillment of a specifically personal one. It is, of course, true that historically, the question of the extent to which difference should be cultivated or controlled has been a subject of much heated debate, ranging over fields as diverse as political philosophy and aesthetic theory. In reference to the arts, classical, in particular neoclassical theory, insisted upon the importance of formal tradition and the concomitant need to restrain deviant excesses, while romantic artists and critics hoisted the flag of art as self-expression, and therefore championed the pursuit of personal and even idiosyncratic or iconoclastic inclination. In the transition from the classic to the romantic, as the debate developed in his book From Classic to Romantic and Elsewhere, was in part marked by a change in the attitude towards concepts such as originality, with reference to which the appearance of Edward Young's Conjectures on Original Composition in 1759 was somewhat of a turning point. If we were to define a Torah attitude with respect to this issue, I presume it would be closer to the classical than to the romantic approach. The sense of discipline and tradition is, of course, central to halacha, and therefore paramount within the hadith. And certainly, as compared to either classical secular liberalism or many contemporary strains of religious self-expression, Yahadis is both restrictive and homogeneous. However, this point should certainly not be exaggerated. While the form and much of the content of even spiritual experience is halachically prescribed, great latitude remains for the expression of personal inclination. Considered from the standpoint of their inner essence rather than their external form, the religious lives of Sidon and Snagdon, for instance, as its memory serves me correctly, I believe that President Lamb once noted in a lecture, the religious lives of Sidon and Snagdon are profoundly different, with one of the differences, perhaps, being this very point, the extent to which they find variety within religious experience palatable or even desirable. Stories told of one of the Gedolim of the previous generation, on one occasion, that on one occasion he noted in Rosh Hashanah that his son had stood for Shmoneh Esrei somewhat longer than he had. story goes that he went over to him and asked him, "Tell me, does your master have a longer text than mine?" To a Hussy, virtually breastfed in the celebrated story of Odisha and Apollo, that he felt that his judgment we passed upon him eventually, not for having failed to attain a particular objective goal, but for having failed to realize that which he personally had carved out to be and could have been. So Hussey, nothing could be more damning, perhaps even more anathematic, than this story. And at this point, I must confess to being very firmly within the Siddhisha corner. But then again, perhaps not really. For it was after all the Gra, presumably the fountainhead of Misnagdis, who in a celebrated comment in his Pirush HaMishlei noted that not only particular experiences, but the whole thrust of one's Avedas Hashem, and therefore one's very being, should ideally bear a personal stamp in accordance with one's own inclination. In this connection, perhaps one might note a tshuva of the Rashba. Rashba was asked, with regard to a shliach tzibur echazim, shekor le'ovei v'noi l'ashremi, v'marich b'tzilosek n'shishmu l'om, kor le'ovei v'nisboi b'zo, v'samech b'kor le'ovei, v'date b'chach, b'eshu n'ispale, v'oimer sh'rov b'chach, v'shei samech b'luba, im lo'o l'ilchoi s'boi sh'rov l'as v'tzilosek achmini, v'eich yi azo n'ishanin n'techsinch, the reference to a chazan is voice pleasant, sweet to its listener, and chazanim apparently in medieval times, like the contemporaries today are inclined to do, would daven at length in order that people should hear the nice voices, and was very pleased with his voice, and think about it, the time that he would daven, and would apparently admit that he thought of this, and he was glad and rejoiced over this. And the question was whether one should protest, inasmuch as tefillah is supposed to be tachnun, cries for, and how can a person beg, implore, imprecate out of joy? And Rashba's reply was, Dvarim eilu acha kavona talev yem amuri, im shliach tzibur ze sameach belibo, al shenesein ha-shevach v'adoy al Hashem b'kol ovel v'vim ino v'sameach mitech yiro hove al avroch. These matters are said, stated, formulated with reference to the intention of the heart. And if this chazan is happy in his heart over the fact that he gives praise and thanksgiving to the Rebbeinu Shleilam with a pleasant and sweet voice, and rejoices out of fear, let blessings devolve upon him. The pluralistic motif, the sense that up to a point, and I stress, of course, up to a point, Eilu ve'eilu divrei elokim chayim can apply to religious experience, to the nature of religious experience, as well as to the nuances of conceptual analysis, is here very clearly expressed. And this, too, is a component of individuality as both fact and value. This, too, reflects the point which Avchaim Zichrono Livracha, book, emphasized so repeatedly, that man is to be regarded as yachid, velo echad, as singular and not as one. Finally, individuality entails not only singularity and difference, but by extension, solitary. Individual existence implies, perhaps not logically, but surely psychologically, a dimension of loneliness. The scope of that dimension is open to question. And again, the contrast in classical and romantic theory and practice is instructive. On the one hand, Dr. Johnson morbidly incantating the admonition he had extracted from Robert Burton's The Anatomy of Melancholy, be not solitary, be not idle. On the other hand, the glorification of solitude, which runs like a red thread in so much English and European poetry, romantic poetry, from Gray's Elegy, to Words of a Solitary Reaper, Chateaubriand, and Arnold's lyrics. I'd like to focus on a particular aspect which is especially close to home. Well, this is the area of religious experiences. Religion generally, as its historians and sociologists never tire of reminding us, of course includes a major communal component. And this certainly has not been neglected within halakha. But it is equally clear that the personal element is, to say the least, no less important, that the capacity for yisvedus and yisvadus, for solitude is the communion, what Plotinus, in a famous phrase, described as the flight of the alone to the alone, is essential. Even if we should hesitate to accept Whitehead's definition that religion is solitariness, we can hardly reject his contention that, quote, if you have never been solitary, you have never been religious. And this, I might add, not only if you have never been solitary within a religious context, even if you have never been solitary within a social context. Thus, whoever cannot for a moment be solitary within other areas is unlikely to be able to achieve solitude within his interpersonal relation with others. This dual sense of the communal and the solitary within religious life is perhaps to be found within different views or interpretations of Shir HaShirim. If Shir HaShirim allegorizes at one level, as Rashi following the Medrash held, the relationship of Knesset Yisrael to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, describes at another level, as the Rambam held, the Pelerinage de la Vie Humaine, the odyssey of the individual soul in quest of its lover and beloved. Chol Shir HaShirim, Mashal Hu Inyan Zeh, all of Shir HaShirim, says the Rambam, is an allegory with respect to this matter. Again, the degree to which either strain is emphasized may vary. But, with with regard to trying to define a Jewish perspective vis-a-vis this question, I prefer not to opt for one side as opposed to the other, but to speak instead of a tensile balance between the two. Not, of course, a tepid via media, but a dialectical position which rejects the extremes of cloister hermitage or immersion within the mass as ways of life on the one hand, but which insists on the other upon the need for both individual and public elements within the full range of spiritual experience. This position is patently exemplified by the phenomenon of prayer. On the one hand, al pi halacha, tefillah is an important public aspect. Tefillah b'tzibur, while according to most poskim, evidently not mandatory, the Maharil even held that it was not included in all the bar mitzvah, nevertheless, it's clearly held up as a norm and as an ideal. Moreover, even if a person cannot daven with Sibu, he should at least do so with a daven the Beit HaKnesset, in literally the House of Assembly. The Beit HaMikdash, which among other things is described in Tanakh, the Beit Tefillah is a house of prayer, is defined al pi halacha, they use the Ramban's phrase, as knufia, as a place of gathering. And yet tefillah also bears a very intimate, a very solitary stamp. Among the hilchos gevuros, important fundamental halachas which are to be derived from the nature of Chanukah prayer, the Gemara in Brachos lists the Kerla Yishomea Mikan She'osu Lagbia Kerla B'Tzilosim, and her voice could not be heard. From here we derive that it is forbidden for a person to raise his voice in prayer. Elsewhere, it would appear from the Gemara that there are perhaps relatively ancillary reasons for this issue. The Gemara suggests at one point tefillah b'lachash, that a silent prayer is preferable, either because, as the Gemara in Brachos of Chofei states, the Meshmeh Kerla b'tzivos ha'rezim iktani almanach, the person speaks loudly in tefillah, seems somehow to intimate that were he to speak falsely, the Rabbein Shalom could not hear him, and therefore he is a man of petty faith. Or, as the Gemara in Seita indicates, in the Gemara tikkun tefillah b'lachash, why was it that tefillah was instituted silently? In order that people who want to include some specific personal element, describe a particular individual sin, should not be humiliated. Against prayer which can be heard by one's fellow would suggest, and as indeed the Baal HaTanya and the Likutei Teva clearly state, the Kerla Yishomea can be seen as being also mandated in order to maintain the intimate character of tefillah, in order to preserve it as an expression, used wrong phrase, of the lonely man in the faith quest for the Rebbein Shlomo. And this dual nature is the same tefillah, the lachash and the tzibur, accurately reflect the concurrent concern with both communal and solitary facets of religious experience particularly, and of the inner life generally. As regards man's ultimate destiny, the Medrash one point, Yen Shmeisabit. And this, contrary both to popular imagination and to the impression clearly conveyed by Ramori Chazal in other places, indeed suggests that that destiny is to be found in utter solitude. Within the context of a story concerning a discussion between Rashim and Halaster, his wife, and Rebbe, Medrash states that Rashim and Halaster's wife said to Rebbe, does then one person see another, relate to another, in the world to come? Is not then each tzaddik the world unto himself? Shenema, as it is written, Pasim Kehelet. Shehele Chodom al Beis Elomai, Vesavu Vashuka Seifdim. Elomi makes his son, Elo Elomai. For the man is going to the home, to the house of his world, and the mourners move about in the marketplace. Does not speak of worlds in the plural, but of his world in the singular. Be this as it may, however, as regards man's mundane and terrestrial existence, his religious and spiritual experience included, he lives within the dialectic of community and solitude. So much for individuality. We turn now to consider our second subject, individualism. In some context, as a glance at the Oxford English Dictionary reveals, the term is largely synonymous with individuality. In others, however, it is clearly different. And in dealing with an ism, we move from a phenomenon to an ideology, from a reality to an attitude, possibly also from a specific value to an ordering of priority. Individualism, too, includes a number of components. It subscribes first to self-determination. The notion that whatever the merit of cultivating or restricting heterogeneity, a question which I discussed previously, it is purely up to the person involved to define its limits for him or herself. So long as he does not impinge directly upon the lives of others, he should be totally free to manage his or her own as he or she sees fit. And at the choice, to use the pose of Arnold's antinomy, between culture and anarchy, should be left, leading perhaps to anarchy, to the individual himself. Secondly, perhaps as a corollary to self-determination, the doctrine of individualism espouses self-assertion. It holds that optimally a person should be able to express his abilities, his interests, his ideas to the fullest. It is only the direct threat to others justifying minimal external restrictions. With Ricardo, it favors free trade, and with Mill, it espouses free thought. With regard to the competition of fecund and contending forces, it is sportsman eager delight. And it claims, moreover, that the process redounds to the ultimate benefit of society at large, inasmuch as the challenge of competition produces stronger muscles on one hand and better mousetraps on the other. With reference to the point cited heretofore, I think it should be obvious that the Ahadith largely rejects these contentions. When all is said and done, and whatever we may say of its liberating influence and impact, the fact, of course, remains that halacha is to a great extent a form of bondage. And the Torah, of course, does not mince words with regard to this. Avodayim shiratzeis emeretz Mitzrayim, they are my servants, whom I have taken out of the land of Egypt. And if we move from self-determination to self-assertion, even a casual examination of halacha concerning, for instance, ahakas sheni, law of governing, or second pack of Malabasa, the relationship among neighbors, or the extent to which competition should be free, open, wide open, even a casual glance at these halachas suggests that a very restrictive thread runs through a great many. And as to the notion that pressing self-interest ultimately enhances and advances the public interest, a notion differently advanced in different circles, Mandeville in the early 18th century, defining this as a kind of paradox, that private vice produces public virtue, while classical capitalistic theory in its early phases, Adam Smith down, held that even at the private level, this became a kind of private virtue as well. This notion stands, I believe, again, thoroughly opposed to Jewish thought. And this not only because it is indeed quite uncertain that the public interest is ultimately served by totally free competition. After all, there are many weak to be considered, and I think in 19th century social thought, we have to consider not only the early phase of self-interest theory, but the notion of social Darwinism with its readiness to sacrifice the weak as well. But apart from this, you have to suggest this position because of its concern not only for the product, not only for the output, but for the input and the motivation of moral activity. And I believe it would be accurate to say that we would be ready to sacrifice some measure of public economic advance in order to attain a greater degree of social harmony and a higher level of ethical motivation. But if we're dealing with individualism as a whole, its primary thrust is perhaps not so much self-determination or self-assertion as specific programs. Its primary thrust is rather teleological. Its concept, man's goal, his end, his destiny. And it is upon this, inasmuch as it relates to both the material and the spiritual order, that I wish to focus. Individualism holds so long as a person doesn't harm others. He may regard the world as his castle. That it is his right, and with regard to the spiritual order, perhaps even his duty, to advance his own needs, even if he largely ignores those of others. That he can assume he has been created in order to mold his own spiritual being and shape his spiritual destiny, and that he may view the entire universe as a supporting task, subserving that grand purpose. It holds in short that for the normative purposes of directing his own activity, a person may view himself as the center, nay, as the alpha and omega of both the microcosm of his own existence and the macrocosm of its context. Baldwin stated, this seemingly egoistic position may sound exaggerated, and yet it contains both a psychological and a moral truth. Psychologically, it is of course true that to some extent we do, each of us, regard our own destiny as the focus of our being. In some sense, every person feels not only, as Louis XV did, après moi le déluge, after myself the flood, but it's converse, après le déluge, moi, after the flood, at least myself. The moral element is perhaps less obvious. But it's true. The moral truth within this is not to be denied. The notion that one should regard the world as having been created to serve him is drawn, after all, not from the pages of Ayn Rand, but from Mishneh Sanhedrin. The Fikoch, inasmuch as man is created in the singular, Chayav Loimar, each is obligated to say, Bishvili, for myself, Nivra Ha'ilon, has the world been created. Less broadly stated, therefore, this doctrine can have a very clear pull, and consequently we need to understand in what sense it is or is not valid from a Jewish perspective. In doing so, I believe we should distinguish, with reference particularly to man's spiritual existence, between two questions. First, what is the purpose, tell us, of man, of a man's creation? Second, how is it to be realized? With reference to the former, we have in the Pasuk, at least in one interpretation, a very clear statement. Whatever the motives underlying creation, and with respect to this, I accept the view held by, among others, Reb Chaim, that this is the Gedra, the Muslim Mincha, and that of this we can say nothing intelligent. Whatever the motives underlying creation, the Pasuk, again in one interpretation, clearly describes its purpose. Kol ha-nikro v'shmi, says the Pasuk in Yeshayo, Kol ha-nikro v'shmi v'lechvodi d'rosi yitzarti. All that which is called in my name, for my honor, I have created it, molded it, yea, even made it. Well, Rashi understands this to refer tzaddikim to the righteous, of whom it would particularly be said that they are nikra b'shmei shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Radak understands, as I would prefer to understand, that it refers to the whole of creation. All, the world, and hence also man, exists for the greater glory, was created for enhancing the glory of the Rebbeinu Shlomo. How is that glory to be enhanced, however? In two ways. First, by building society and shaping history so that they reflect Kavod Shem Shamayim, by combating evil, by promoting justice, by defeating idolatry, by disseminating the knowledge and the worship of the Rebbeinu Shlomo. Yod al kei skor del chomel Hashem ha'molech v'deyodoy, as also in Rashi quotes it, that neither the name of the Rebbeinu Shlomo nor strong is complete until such time as evil is defeated. So the struggle against evil and contrarily the promotion of good enhances Shem Shamayim. This is one aspect, the Kiddush Shem Shamayim of the public and historical realm. But there is concurrently a growth in Kavod Shamayim and the glory of the Rebbeinu Shlomo, which takes place within the bounds of personal existence. There is Kiddush Hashem, both theologically and halachically, B'seisah in private, as well as B'rabi in public. The individual's growth in commitment to and love of the Rebbeinu Shlomo, in knowledge and implementation of Torah, is itself an extension and a deepening, as it were, of the Rebbeinu Shlomo's domain. And while this too may be expressed in public, it nevertheless is a fulfillment within each and every individual. And this, as the Ramban states at the end of Parshas Bo, V'hi kavanasa yetzira, and this is the goal of creation, the purpose of creation, she'en lo nita'am achir b'yitzira rishayno ve'en lo yoyim b'tachteinu chesed. מלבד זה שידע האדם וידע ללכוב שברוי. There is no other reason for the first creation, the primal creation. And the Rebbeinu Shlomo has no other desire, so to speak, within the netherworld, apart from this, that man should know him and should acknowledge to the Rebbeinu Shlomo, should know and should acknowledge to the Rebbeinu Shlomo that he has created him. Chavonas Reim Mutzakir B'Tzkila Yisach Chavonas B'Tiknes Tzir Yisach Chus Tzidah Sarabim Zehu She'i Aliv Ne'odo Mokim Yitzkabtu Yedu Lekir Shebron Ve'im Tziyam V'Yifalsu Muzeh Ve'yoyim Rulufonov V'Yitzach Manach. And the purpose of the intent of loud prayer and the purpose of having what the kesiyos and the virtue, the merit of public prayer is this, that there should be a place where people can gather, acknowledge the Rebbeinu Shlomo, that he has created them, and should publicize this and say to him, we are your creature. But there is, whether expressed in solitude or in public assembly, a dimension of Yinakadish Shem Shamayim, and therefore realizing the purpose of Yitzira, within the confines of individual religious experience. But here we come to an additional, and I believe to a decisive term. Let us assume that an individual fulfills the purpose of his existence by tending to his own spiritual perfection. But how is that to be attained? The answer, of course, is in part through purely egocentric activity, to various channels of spiritual self-expression and self-realization. But in part two, and it is this which I wish to emphasize, also through a concern for others and action on their behalf, through a concern for both Reb Yisrael and Klal Yisrael, through a commitment both to caring for the spiritual and material needs of other individuals, qua individuals, and for molding larger historical forces and moving Knesset Yisrael specifically and humanity generally ever so slightly closer to the fulfillment of a meta-historical and eschatological vision of Le'yirei v'le'yashchisi b'chol har kodshi v'ubo lo haaretz de'yaretz Hashem kamayim la'yom achati. They shall neither do evil nor destroy my holy mount. The earth shall then be its full knowledge of God as water covering the sea. It was not only of the universe or society at large that the Mishnah and others spoke, when it stated that the world stands upon three things, not only upon the two legs of inner personal experience of Torah and Tefillah, but upon the third of Gilus Chassadim as well. In the Chazal, there are some very sharp words with reference to the divorce of Gilus Chassadim from Torah and Tefillah. This is mildly expressed, if you will, in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. It states of two great Amoraim, Abaye and Rabbe, one lives to be, or Rabbe Rabbe Yisrael, the one lives to be 40, the other lives to be 60. One lives to be 40 because he had engaged only in Torah. The other was Zechus, or Tziomi, because he had engaged in Yunus Chassadim as well. But it is much more sharply stated in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Must say that Chanina ben Tragi and Rabbi Elazar ben Paratus were both arrested by the Romans and were about to be executed. Rabbi Elazar ben Paratus said to Chanina ben Tragi, "You are fortunate. You have been caught. And as regards to Ben Shlem, you have only one Avera. Woe is to me who have been caught with reference to the cause of five sins." And Chanina ben Tragi answered him, "Ashrecho sha'ata nitfasta al chamisha dvorim v'ata nitsa, oy li shenitfasti al dover echod ve'eni nitsa. Fortunate are you that you have been caught with reference to five sins, and you are to be saved. Woe is unto me that I have indeed been caught with only one thing, and I am doomed. Shata sakta b'tera v'gvilus chasodim, v'ani lo sakti ala b'tera b'ilvat. You engaged in both tera and gvilus chasodim, whereas I devoted myself to tera exclusively." And the Gemara explains v'chid Rav Huna, as Rav Huna stated, "Yoma Rav Huna kol oisik b'tera b'ilvat, whoever engages in tera exclusively, dome k'mishen l'eleka, resembles a person who has no God. Shenema, as it is written, V'yomim rabim l'Yisroel alo elokeyem." There's a long period for Knesset Yisroel without a true God. The Gemara asks, "My lo elokeyem," apparently a God they had, but not the true one. כל העסק בטבע בלבד, you engage a soul in טבע, ignoring גבילות הפרדים, דומה כמי שאין לו אלוקה, resembles one who has no God. The very realization of teleological individualism, with reference at least to the spiritual sphere, requires therefore a full measure of altruism. This is perhaps, as of all people Lionel Trilling noted, the simple meaning of the Mishneh Novit. Mele nili mili, kshani l'atmi mo'ani, which presents what Trilling there described as the Wordsworthian essence, quote, the interplay between individualism and the sense of community, between an awareness of the self that must be saved and an awareness that the self is yet fulfilled only in community. To say, as the Mishneh Sanhedrin says, one ought to say, that Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam is not therefore to take out a claim for spiritual self-indulgence or to divest oneself of responsibility for one's context. The world was indeed prepared for me. And I, like a good guest, am all the more beholden to its maker and mind for it. But now that it has been created, I am enjoined to preserve and to mold it. L'avdo u'l'shamba, to tend its garden and to tend its inhabitants. The individual, Niebuhr wrote, The Nature and Destiny of Man, faces the eternal in every moment and in every action of his life, and he confronts the end of history with his own death. The dimension of his freedom transcends all social realities. His spirit is not fulfilled in even the highest achievements of history. His conscience is not at ease, but even the most unequivocal approbation of historical courts of judgment. Nor need it be finally intimidated by historical condemnation. On the other hand, the individual's life is meaningful only in its organic relation to historical community, tasks, and obligations. This brings me in conclusion to my practical and hortatory concerns. In thinking about the respective Jewish communities, including the Torah segments, in Eretz Yisrael and in the United States, with respect to our problem, I sense that each is somewhat out of kilter, but in a different direction. In Eretz Yisrael, the collective sense is very keenly felt. In part, perhaps due to common danger. In part, at least within certain circles, to the pervasive influence of Rav Kook. In part, and this, not just in a mystical sense, because the concept of Olvus for Yisrael HaRegin Zelozeh has, as the Gemara Sanhedrin, and subsequently the Maral and the Avnezel pointed out, a very particular, in the Gemara there in the halachic sense, a very particular significance within Eretz Yisrael. What is sometimes felt to be deficient there is the sense of individuality, of initiative, of creativity, of difference, of singularity. before I speaking there, there's that aspect, the need to appreciate and to promote it that I would emphasize. But on these shores, I have a feeling I would wish to be proven wrong. But I have a feeling that the converse is true. That the sense of concern with oneself, be it within the relatively material sphere, the pursuit of a career, or with respect to the spiritual order, with reference to one's own self-realization and fulfillment, that sense is amply and keenly felt. I'm not certain the other side of the coin, the sense of community, the sense of common purpose, the sense of public need, the sense of milus chasodim, concern not only for other individuals, qua individuals, but also for Knesset Yisrael as a total community, but that need is equally and properly felt. In any balanced Jewish perspective, however, that need, no less than the personal, the individual, that need needs to be felt, felt fully, felt sharply, felt profoundly. I would hope whatever I said this evening may provide, if indeed such an element is necessary, an element may help to maintain, to develop in its fuller and its ampler sense, a kind of balance between community and individualism, if you will, between individuality and individualism, which I think a full and a proper Jewish perspective can really require.
Rosh Hashiva, Rav Lichtenstein has agreed to take some questions if anyone would like to pose questions.
The question was as to how I would regard a career which has no public aspect whatsoever, but is very personally self-fulfilling, and particularly the aesthetic experience. This is a question which, within the general cultural context, was the subject of a great deal of debate. Particularly within the 19th century. If you read, just to take a couple of examples, both Keats' poems and his letters, if you read Tennyson, you read Arnold, this is a problem which animated a great deal of Romantic and subsequently Victorian thought. I would, if you ask me for my own views on this, I would say, first of all, that I'm not certain that I would accept your definition that art indeed totally devoid of a kind of public purpose, that in some sense one should go along with Shelley's definition of poets being the unacknowledged legislators of the world, or with Victor Hugo's statement that if you say the artist is in a cloud, but le tonnerre aussi, so is the thunder. And that in a sense, an artist does contribute a great deal to the public order, even if that is not his immediate purpose, but simply either from a classical perspective, representing or imitating and therefore more sharply delineating existing reality, or from the more modern romantic perspective, giving vent where that personality is meaningful to his own personality. But this itself contributes a great deal to enlarging the bounds of human vision, and that this is therefore a significant moral contribution in its own right. Now, if one were not to accept this, I would say that whether a person would be able to or should engage in this kind of career depends in part on what competing needs are. Certainly if a person in a situation where people all around him are in one sense or another drowning, then to engage in what is perhaps a very satisfying, a spiritually meaningful kind of experience such as art, is nevertheless to be a chassid shreita. Even to engage in talmudei under those circumstances is not commendable. If a person is in a situation where other needs are not so pressing, then I think it's a somewhat different story. I certainly would not pursue the, to use Arnold's phrase, the kind of philistine notion that art is, in as much as it's not economically or productive, therefore is not to be regarded as being meaningful.
Yes, sir.
I didn't discuss Marxism. I do not question the merits of private property. I am myself a firm believer in it, but I don't think that that is really relevant to my remarks. Yes. Where the element of conscience that you describe does come into play is in the area of interpretation, to some extent. That is where one might try to press for a given understanding, a given interpretation, in order to try to, if not to eliminate, at least to minimize the current conflict between the dictates of his own moral conscience and what he finds in Torah, what he finds in Halacha. But where, and that I think is a perfectly legitimate pursuit. However, we're having gone the last mile in that direction, and it clearly has its limits, and I don't mean to suggest otherwise. Having gone the last mile in that direction and being able to go no further, then clearly the Munna requires that a person submit, and I repeat, this has been from the very dawn of Jewish community, but this again would take us somewhat afield.